Number 20A.
Well, last year we did the Gospel of John and have taken every aspect of that Gospel of John, interpreting it in its system and in its structure. This year, really, we wanted to take the opportunity to see the implications of the Gospel of John. And so I have taken one or the other aspect that I felt was adapted to show how we can elaborate on the text of St. John. And we have done that with the first part, then with the second part from the point of view of truth. But that seems to me for the moment sufficient so as to know how to use a method of science from the textbook in order to elaborate on the text of gospel. So today I want to take the time to touch on a subject that is necessary perhaps to investigate so that we again can see that the Gospel of John makes terrific statements, that those statements are not explained, they are only explained really when we know the textbook. So one of the big points that is always brought out is, well, this is all a nice presentation, but it's a theory, it's intellectual, and it's not practical. So let me spend a little time on the question of theory and practice, because I feel that there is a lot of misunderstanding between theory and practice. Alone, the question that comes up, which says, well, this is theory but not practical, is already showing that there is a misunderstanding about those two terms of theory and practice. So that it is believed that those two fields are separate fields, that there is a field of theory and then that there is a field of application. You must apply it, and therefore one has in the consciousness a real duality, a duality which thinks there is a field of theory and there is a field of application, as if there were two different fields, which introduces a duality within our consciousness. And that, again, alone, I would say, is a great mistake and has not been thought out properly. Now, theory and practice is one. We do not have a theory and then next to it a practice. John Dahl used to point that out very clearly. He said it is as if we would have a theory and use that theory as a plaster and then plaster it on the body in order that to apply it so that we consider this as an application. Now, this is naturally quite explainable, because in the human we very often use that subject of application by thinking that there is something that is used to apply to something else, and we make in a human experience that difference, which does not apply really to theory and practice in a science at all. Theory and practice are one. That's the very first point that we have to take in and to contemplate, so that we don't make a difference or a duality out of it. Way back already in the Greek philosophy, Aristotle would say that he considered a theory as the most humane practice. So the good theory is the most humane practice itself. So there is not a theory and then a practice. If we take a modern scientific philosopher, then we find perhaps this definition from Langfield, which says, nothing is more practical than a good theory. So a good theory is the most practical thing that we know. Or he says, and nothing is more impractical than a practice without theory. So that's the most impractical thing, to have a practice without theory. We know there are so many people that feel they don't need a theory, they are practical people, and that they have a practical hand, and therefore they don't need a theory. Well, this may apply to many many human activities, but in a science we can't make that distinction. We must really see that any application, any practice without the theory is not a practice, it's a wrong practice, because practice must be built on a theory, and a good theory, and if that theory is very good, then it means that that theory incorporates every practical application. That is a theory that is applicable to every situation, and so only that is a good theory, which is universal, which is all-embracing, and which embraces every part. So let's see that we get rid of that funny distinction between, yes, he has the theory, but he has not the practice. Or, yes, he practices it, though he doesn't know the theory. So this is a wrong statement. So let's see that the theory is what? A theory is usually considered as a fundamental program, as a fundamental theorem that is so big that it is basic for every individual aspect of that field on which it is a theory. So a theory is a fundamental program, and the more explicit that theory is, the more it is really covering every possible application of that theory. Which means that every element or every situation, every aspect within that field can be covered by the theory. We cannot have any calculation in arithmetic which is not built on the theory of arithmetic. So in arithmetic, we know, I always take that example because it's the most explicable example, that in arithmetic we cannot say, well, he practices his arithmetic, but he doesn't know the theory of it. That just doesn't make sense. But the moment we apply it to another field as an exact science, we think that we can make that a difference. So practice would mean that we would know which place value it takes within a theory, so that we can build really this specific situation into the theory, and therefore know how that theory works in its individual part of that theory. That's why we must see that, say, look into the concordance and see, does Mrs. Eddy really talk such a lot about application? The students talk a lot about that the theory must be applied, the Christian science must be applied, and always, yes, but it must apply, yes, but it must be applied, as if the theory would exclude its application. That's and if one looks up in the textbook what she says about apply and applying, one can see then when she refers to that term in regard to Christian science, then one sees that she uses that term very seldom. She doesn't use it as much as the students use it. She only uses it really in a positive way for applying application in science only 6 times in her textbook. And then when we ask what does she mean with application, then we can see easily that she says, well, we apply the rules. We don't apply Christian science as if we would take a principle and then like a plaster put over a disharmonious situation in order to solve it. But that application means that the principle is applied within its own field, within its own principle, but not applied to something outside that principle. That's not application. So she talks about the rules for the application of the divine principle. So it says that the rules of principle really are necessary in order to show that the principle interprets itself as a theory so that it applies to every situation. Then we have the rules of application. Or she speaks about the law of God must be applied. The law of God must be applied. That's a very short statement, and it seems a very obvious statement, but it's not so quite obvious when we come to a living living sense of it, because then we are tempted really to misunderstand that and take that law of God and think that we can apply it, say, to sickness or to disease or to sin or to a disharmonious situation, as if the divine principle would know a disharmonious situation. The law of God does not know a false law, a material law, an incorrect law. That is outside the realm of the divine principle. So she says that the power of truth as applied through the Christian system. That's what she says. That's on page 150. You can read it. It's not from me. This is indicating very clearly that application is what? That we can take really the power of truth and apply it through the system. Not apply it to a disharmonious situation. That's a very great difference. And this is the difference that we have to be aware of, or else we always try to solve a problem or give a treatment that is fundamentally wrong, so we think it is Christian Science, where we try to apply the divine principle to a disease. Well, this is not possible, because the divine principle doesn't know anything about the disease. It only knows its own laws. It never goes outside its own realm, because there is no outside of its own realm. And therefore, we must be very careful when we think about this way. So we have to admit, so to say, to ourselves that we put our human sense of application into the theory of Christian Science. We do it, and that is what is wrong. Whereas if we should see what does the textbook say about application, and the textbook always says that the divine principle applies itself through its system, that it applies its own rules. And those system and those rules and those laws, that the laws of God must be applied. The laws of God never go outside the laws of God. They don't know an outside. They always stay within, really, the rhythm of that principle. And I think this is a big point that we perhaps once have to state here, in order that we are clear about theory and practice, or about principle and practice, so that we are not blindly, with the best of what we think we do, apply the divine principle in a wrong way, and are very astounded that it doesn't work. And then we think, yes, well, I couldn't make my demonstration, or I don't have enough understanding, and that's true, because that understanding is not there. It's a misunderstanding about the question of principle and practice. Yes, so the question still is, and I still talk around it so as to perhaps be able to make it clear, and John Dolly in his practice book, and also especially in Ezekiel, shows very clearly that we make these mistakes through thinking that we can apply truth to an error, that we can apply truth to sickness. This can't be done, because truth only knows truth. Truth does not know anything outside of itself. It does not know the mortal. It does not know the sick man. It does not know the kind of sickness he has. Truth only knows its own ideas. Truth only knows the perfect man. That is what happens within, really, the one truth. So we still have to take up then, why then does truth still work so that it can bring about a healing. So still that question is open. And the very first thing that naturally we have to see is, first of all, that not we can apply truth. That truth applies itself. Nobody can make God work. He's too big a guy that we can tell him what to do and what not to do. Truth is applying itself, and not we applying the truth. So it applies itself. How does truth apply itself? Well, truth applies itself then when we lift up our consciousness to the point of truth or to the divine principle and begin to fill our consciousness with the ideas of the divine truth and see how these ideas of truth are operated by its divine principle. So we look into the immensity of the divine principle and see that divine principle always operates according to law and order and rule and system and science in its harmonious operation, so that we can see now that all that there is going on is actually this wonderful truth. So we fill our consciousness really with the right ideas of God, with the right ideas of man. We are always in the realm of right ideas, the right ideas of health, the right ideas of harmony, of happiness, of holiness, whatever may be at stake, but always right ideas of the divine principle. That's the application. Then we apply really the principle by seeing that we should take the standpoint of that principle and really go along with that principle and see what does that infinite mind know about principle's own realm of ideas. Then we apply really divine mind, the divine spirit, the divine soul and principle. Then we really apply life, truth and love by letting those synonymous apply themselves. Then we have taken the right standpoint and we don't have a feeling that we must make mind be aware of a situation, and we don't have a feeling that we must spirit tell what the order of spirit is and so on, so that we draw back, that we get out of the picture. As Mrs. Eddy has said, she had the best healings when she put Mary out of the way, when no personal thinking enters in, but when we fill our consciousness with God, with the divine principle, and not with what man thinks about the situation. So in this way, what are we demonstrating? In this way, we actually are demonstrating what is the Son of Man. We are not demonstrating the healing of a sick man. There is no sick man. From principle, there is no sick man. If we think that principle has to apply to a sick man, then we are accepting that there is a duality in being, that there is a divine principle that is all harmonious, and outside that divine principle is another reality, a sick man with a certain kind of problem that he has, and then we have built up a duality, and that never works. So we begin, therefore, to see that our practice, our treatment, is not that we treat a sick person. We see that treatment is really principle viewing itself, principle seeing its own realm of ideas, principle seeing really the perfect man and nothing else but the perfect man. So that we have a right starting point. It's not the whole of the treatment yet, but it is the right starting point that we have taken. So what does that accomplish, really? If we see only from the point of view of principle, the infinite interpretation of that principle as a universe, including man, and see a universe that does not need to be saved, that a man that does not to be healed because man is incapable of sin, sickness and death, then when we see that, what do we do? What happens then? So what happens then is that we exclude from our consciousness that there can be a universe outside the divine principle. We exclude in our consciousness that there can be a mortal, that there can be sickness, sin and death, that there can be a material law at work, that there can be a disharmonious law at work. That is then excluded through our staying within the divine principle. So we can see that the healing does not take place in the sick man or in the sickness, but in the belief that we correct within ourselves. So you see, everything is happening within understanding. So if within our understanding we only establish really the seven synonymous terms in their universe of ideas and see that universe of ideas and see the perfect man, as Jesus saw in science the perfect man, this does what? This heals our misunderstanding. Doesn't in the first place heal the sick. It heals our understanding. Or in other words, it sets our understanding right so that we don't have a misunderstanding of God and man and the universe. That's where the healing takes place, within our consciousness. That's why it is so important to see what we saw in the two translations, where we saw that the two translations hinge on that pivotal point of understanding. That everything takes place at the point of understanding, that through the first translation, if we see that principle only translates itself into its infinite idea of principle, that is the way we should understand the realm of ideas or the true universe, including man, and that understanding is not at the same time misunderstanding. Understanding is understanding and not at the same time belief. So that understanding resolves the possibility of entertaining a belief. That's why it starts right away to resolve the first degree and sees that the first degree is not real. And it begins to resolve the second degree to see that also not ideational. And so it shows that only that which is ideational is of the nature of understanding, and that's the third degree. So we see that really in our understanding, the understanding of ideas resolve the belief in something else. And if the belief yields, then the situation yields. So the healing takes place within our understanding. One can see why, therefore, Mrs. Eddy puts so much stress on that point where she says that Christian Science has been revealed as a science of celestial being, and that science must be demonstrated as an immanent eternal science. That's the application, that we demonstrate that principle as an immanent eternal science. And not as a phenomenal exhibition. She says so. I'm sorry to say, it's not my theory. I get everything out of the textbook. I don't accept anything which I don't find to be substantiated in the textbook, because I know the bigness of Mrs. Eddy's revelation and the exactness of Mrs. Eddy's revelation, and that nothing can equal that revelation, that we can go to any other science and any other metaphysical or psychic group that doesn't amount to anything if compared with what Mrs. Eddy revealed. That's why I always like to find my explanation in the textbook. So science must be demonstrated as an immanent eternal science, which means theory and practice means therefore that I go to that science and see it as an eternal science. I see it as what constitutes that eternal science. Then my consciousness is just always roaming in the field of the divine principle that interprets itself through its categories, that interprets itself through the blending of categories, that interprets itself only through ideas of God and never through anything else, that science does not know any error. No science knows error, or it isn't a science. Therefore, that is the application, that I go and see what the divine principle tells me about a certain situation. That's why at that point I really need divine mind reading. And that is a point that is brought out in the textbook over and over, that we can only detect really the specific truth through divine mind reading. And if we detect the specific truth through the divine mind reading, which is within the divine principle, that by the law of opposites shuts out the possibility that there could be a belief about it. It does away with the belief, and if it does away with the belief, it does away with the experience of that belief. So we never really heal a sick body, we always heal our misunderstanding about the divine principle. If that is healed, if that is put straight, then we know that that our understanding, our consciousness, does no more contain, is no more contemplating beliefs. And as we know, beliefs are at the foundation of every disharmonious experience. That's why I like so much that statement, which I have already quoted once or twice, where in prose work Mrs. Eddy shows, yes, we can analyze every disease and bring it back to mortal mind. So to bring it back to a belief. But she doesn't leave it there. She goes on and says, but going right down to the depths of things, we see that there is no mortal mind, because all is mind. So it's not enough to think, well, the cause of all disharmony is mortal mind. That's true, but that's not the whole truth. If we stop there, we stop too early in our analysis. We stop too early because we then still think that there exists such a thing as mortal mind, and we have to get rid of that. Whereas if we see that there is no mortal mind, because all is mind, and mind is all in all, then there is no room for mortal mind, and therefore no more room for the experience of mortal mind.